Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. This episode, like all episodes of the show, is brought to you by Patreon subscribers and patrons. There are no sponsors to this show. There are no ads, like many other podcasts. It is fully listener-supported. So would you please consider supporting the show today at patreon.com/ConnorHabib. Thank you. Friends, this is the first episode in a series of episodes on science and how science interacts and intersects with our lives in surprising ways. Across these episodes, we'll be considering the healing and connective powers of the void of space, terrifying encounters with predators, the development of the concept of nature, reflections on our own animalistic violence, the truth and complications of the scientific method itself, and the ways in which we connect at the tiniest layers of existence. Just as the connections are surprising, so I hope will be the picture of science that emerges. I don't mean science in the dull and deadened way science is spoken about mostly today. Right now, science primarily finds its way into our consciousness through struggles. There are struggles about pharmaceuticals or AI or climate change. Science finds itself located in tensions and the low hums of everyday anxiety. These tensions and battles leave all sorts of new holes and questions and create plenty of rubble and ruins to sort through as well. They're not neat and easy conflicts wherein one side wins out against the other. This has been the case since I've been alive. I'm thinking of when I was younger and evolution was challenged by creationism. And so scientists took a strong and necessary stance against the flimsy perspective of creationists, especially the fundamentalists who were trying to stop evolution from being taught in schools. But so much was missed in those conflicts. So for instance, the centering of creationism in religion as the biggest enemy of science ignored the hijacking of science for private interest, profit, and war, and that funding for research often comes from corporations and states that aren't always interested in the truth if it gets in the way of other aims, and also the way that that created scarcity for funding for other kinds of projects in science. And in fact, that was one of the biggest enemies of doing science well and truthfully and comprehensively. And those battles also seem to necessitate a sort of shorthand science whereby unfounded but powerfully metaphorical views of evolution, like Richard Dawkins's selfish gene theory, were deployed to seize the popular imagination, to rally people against the creationist encroachment on science in schools. But it and some of the other theories of the time were so full of holes and unsubstantiated that they often ended up giving strength to the enemies of evolution, because those creationists could come up with critiques rather easily because there was lots to critique there, even if their conclusions that they drew from those critiques were completely wrong. And of course, there were the new atheists who ended up pushing up colonial narratives by saying that anybody who believed in religion was stupid, and you know, this led to people like Sam Harris saying, you know, just bomb Muslim countries and all that kind of stuff, or you know, whatever. I'm shorthanding the things he said, which were actually much worse than that. And those conflicts also spilled out into other regions. Science versus postmodern philosophy, science versus art, science versus love, where even love became a string of chemical reactions that could be explained away. Science objectified everything in its path, and as it objectifies, it expresses both truth and falsehood. This is why, let me say this whole statement before you jump on me, this is why flat earthers have a point. It's not because the earth is flat. That's not the point that they have. I reject that, of course. But if we look at the sort of inner tension they're expressing, it's something like, hey, science is telling me something. It's giving me information that is counter to my experience. And then it's erasing my experience in favor of the information it offers. So if people are experiencing the world or the earth as a flat plane, and then it is known to be a sphere for many very good reasons, they're saying, yes, but you're getting rid of my experience of this flatness. Now, unfortunately, their tactic is to try to go back into the information and come up with information that merely fits with their experience, instead of trying to see that there is a lemniscate form there, a lemniscate form to being human. and that is that the world is co-created by our experience and the information, the experience of our instruments, and the experience that our arts and our equations give to us. When I was in grad school, I studied science primarily in small organismic and evolutionary biology seminars with the great and groundbreaking scientist Lynn Margulies. The most important thing my science education gave me was the ability to be thoughtfully critical of science. But the second most important thing it gave to me was the inspiration to just love science. So these episodes will not be scientific episodes exactly, but they won't be scientistic either. They will be about the love of exploration of what science can bring into our lives. Not just focusing on whether this or that point, this scientifically proven thing, is true or false, or getting into those kinds of wars or tensions or debates. They will be about philosophical questions, connections with others, inner states of peace, productive dread even. They'll look, in a sense, at how we complete science's offering with moral impulses, with love, with enthusiasm. On this episode, I speak with poet laureate of Amsterdam, novelist and nonfiction writer Marjolein van Heemstra, whose newly translated book, In Light Years, There's No Hurry, gives a portrait of the vital necessity of seeing space and the sky differently, and seeing ourselves differently, and it offers an illuminating and helpful darkness. We talk about the ways in which the overview effect, which is seeing the Earth from space, can be brought into our lives without having to go to the moon. The power of walking in the night. In fact, Marjolein runs night walks in the Netherlands, and the ways that walking in the night can connect people, even who have disparate political beliefs, together. We talk about the fragmentation and the whole of existence, the Hubble telescope, and the need to be expansive, not just contracted or even only mindful in our moment, to confront and live along with the challenges facing us today. Marjolein also reads from her book and a poem, The Middle. I'm so happy to share this first episode on how the sciences find their ways into our lives. Please do subscribe to the show, and please leave a positive review, 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify, as well as a warm review, and please do support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/ConnorAbib. All right, thank you. Here we go. Hello, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. Hello, Marjolein van Heemstra. I wanted to begin talking about disconnection because the connectivity is something that just came up for me a lot reading your In Light Years, There's No Hurry in your recent book, and also In Search of a Name, your novel, and your poetry. And something that came up for me in all the reading was about this disjoint between our everyday lives and the apparent ongoing crisis. How we seem to be living as if nothing's happening. And the dance we do with whether or not that's truthful, deceptive, whether it's a disavowal or a denial, or if it's actually there is something, you know, deeply honest to be living that way. So I really wanted to start there and just think about what has caused that disconnect to begin with. I mean, we can point in so many directions, but since you are looking for, in my reading, you know, these unifying perspectives, is there also in some ways a unity or a unifying view of the disconnection, or is it just totally fragmented, totally scattered?
So it's a big question to begin with. of course, where the disconnection starts is probably what everyone is looking for, right? And Christians will point to Adam and Eve. I mean, all religions. I studied religious science, graduated on Islamic mysticism in the Netherlands. It's very niche. I think I'm the only one that specialized in that. So it's interesting to see that all religious traditions have some story about people falling out of connection with the world. So in a sense, I think that says that it's sort of the human status to be in disconnection. It's a problem for us that we reflect so much on the world, and the reflection gives the distance, and now the distance has grown because, well, there are so many things in between us and the world, and there are so many processes we are disconnected from. But what that first disconnection started, I think that question is actually the mystery of humanity. How did we get disconnected from the world? And we are constantly trying to find ways back to the connection. But I don't have the answer to that, because that's the one of the biggest questions that drives so many people for thousands of years already.
Yeah, sometimes I sort of imagine it as like, as if there's like one droplet of disconnection that happened in the heavens, but that it just then rippled out and out and out. And so what is like a singular tiny event on some other layer has become so multiple as it kind of echoes through time and into our own lives. In light years, there's no hurry. So science-based and natural history-based and so it's not a surprise to me that you would have studied Islamic mysticism in the Netherlands, as all academic things are very niche. I often find when people write books that are looking for something unifying or connecting, or to offer some sort of meaning that's not quite obviously spiritual, sometimes they're doing it in lieu of having any interest in the spiritual or the religious. Like, I can think of plenty of books that are like, you know, let's turn to the Stoics, or let's turn to great literature for our sense of meaning and purpose in the world. And a lot of times those people who write those books aren't really quite interested in religion. So this is a little bit of a surprise, but actually you have this foundational education and interest in that as well.
Yeah, that I hide very well.
And now I've exposed it to the light. Sorry.
I think the sciences, and of course there's many bridges between science and religion. And one of the stories in the book that I think is one of the sort of, I don't know if it's an English term, but the red thread, we say in Dutch, like a red thread throughout the book. One of the important lines that the book is founded upon is that idea of brokenness and the fragmented world, and how these huge vessels of light once broke, and then all these fragments of light came into creation, and the light longs for the light to, you know, to unify like it was before, to be one big vessel of light. So every splinter of light that's in every part of creation has a longing for other splinters, and they always try to come together, and that's what makes people yearn for each other or for truth or for... and that's actually a Jewish story, whatever you want to call it. So I think throughout the books there are quite some religious ideas, only I haven't really called them that way.
I mean, do you feel that this fragmentation and disjointedness is ultimately illusory, or do you think it's actually it, or do you think that it's real? I mean, at which and I know that, you know, I mean, I understand we could say at a certain level it's real, and at a certain level it's illusory. But I also am now kind of wondering, bringing in this spiritual or religious element, if there's a fundamental illusion to it, or actually if you feel that the particularity of the brokenness, of the fragmentedness is
more yeah. essential.
I know what you mean. But as you said, you could say it's both. But maybe if you take it one step further, of course, it's an illusion in the sense that there's only one, you know, creation or one. It's all connected. It's very boring because we know this, but it's all connected. But in the same way, I think we kind of need the brokenness to live this life, because there would be no life, no yearning, no movement if there was no brokenness. So we somehow on this world, on this planet, need the fragments to have movement, to have life at all. Otherwise, there's just a status quo of everything being one and not going anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so absolutely.
It's very necessary. It's not just to say, oh, these fragments are just an illusion, we have to overcome them. No, we actually have to understand the importance of this brokenness, because it's because of the brokenness that we can meet and that we can learn. And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I take that in as, you know, my own sort of foundation is as a esoteric Christian, you know, I mean, mostly informed by anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner, that sort of thing. But for me, the you know, that's part of the revelation of Christianity, is seeing the other suffering and not being able to actually quite identify with that suffering, it being so great and terrible, and also not being able to really relate to that being's love or ability to love, but striving across the distance to meet it. And actually in that striving, something arises out of it. So that separateness, something new comes out of it. Yeah. And what comes out of it is that striving. And it's not just like, you can't ever really become whole again, but you can become new. You can actually heal into a new form or something. You know, I was thinking about this also in terms of your novel In Search of a Name, where the main character who is pregnant is learning all sorts of things about someone who in her life, who had a major, major hero story around them, and having some of the layers of that history fall away. This hero and villain story constantly falling away and falling away, falling away. But then she begins to have a new experience of who this person is and a new experience of what she thinks about her story. So I was thinking about that, the kind of newness that arises out of it through time and through space, trying to form these connections. And that's very much like, you know, a constellation. You look up and you see the stars and they're very far away. But in our story, in our grouping of trying to bring them together, something new comes that we can actually guide ourselves with. I guess that's maybe a way of asking about finding. So what, before we move into talking about, you know, before we move into talking about seeking unity, like, I'm also thinking about the ways in which a kind of healing and newness come out of that brokenness. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit more? Because I think as we start getting into like pulling back and seeing the whole planet and all that, maybe the ways in which you find through constant sense of separation and fragmentation, also the value, the things that are given through that, rather yeah. than something that encompasses it.
Well, that's of course what I try to do in my book, In Light Years, There's No Hurry. I didn't want to just write a book about the universe and cosmological consciousness and how helpful and also healing maybe it can be to be aware of the universe that you're from and to be aware of everything we don't know. At the same time, I wanted to write about the actual boundaries in my own life, because I was looking at the universe to sort of cross these boundaries to heal the brokenness. But then I thought, I have to be honest about the brokenness around me as well, and how difficult it is to overcome that brokenness, which is why I started writing about my neighbor and this little front yard that we share. And in my work, I end my book with the idea to start a group of people who will go walk into the night together to sort of find out what nighttime darkness means and to embrace that more, because, well, we've lost so much of it in Holland. We are one of the most light polluted countries in the world. And in we've done these walks. I've done about 400 night walks since the book was published. And in those night walks, I always take someone along who talks about their own brokenness on a very small scale during the night walk. And I really try to find people who would usually not walk out into the night, you know, not the typical sort of nature-loving, ecological-minded people, but just people who actually don't like the forest at night. And I take them and they meet all these other, well, I don't know, I just try to make a group of people who would never meet each other, take them into the darkness, and then have them talk and think about brokenness. And that can be really amazing. Some of these meetings and walks have been very, well, surprised me a lot. What can happen if you throw people in the mix that would never actually meet and make them go into the dark and have them trust each other and have them listen to each other. So yeah, in my work, I always try to zoom out and at the same time, keep an eye on the brokenness to keep the balance between unity and brokenness, because it feels big, right? If you only talk about how wholesome everything is and how we have to strive for unity. I mean, yes, we do. And at the same time, there's a constant brokenness that sometimes you cannot even overcome. Because I have people, we've done 100 of night walks since the book was published. And we've made this small community of, I call them our night watchers. So they take people into the night. And they are, as I said, from all walks of life. And some of them, for example, voted for the far right party that is now, you know, going to govern Holland, which is devastating. We've had the horrible election since November. So, yeah, in my daily life and daily practice, I really struggle with that brokenness, because these are the people that join in my project. And at the same time, I think what they vote for makes us even more fragmented than ever. And still we share this practice of night walking. And but there's no answer to it. And I'm not searching for it, because I know I'm not going to solve that. Mm. It feels good to still be together and to still walk into the night together.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a, I'm glad you mentioned that last bit there, because it is so, it is, of course, it's important to not lose sight of what the person's political aims or actions might have been in a vote or whatever it may be. But also when you begin to locate the places in which people are connected, I don't know. It's hard, because on the one hand, I want to sort of seek that moment as a kind of opportunity for that person to change. You know, it's like you start like, well, maybe if they just spend enough time in nature in the night with other people, maybe let you. But then what is my impulse there? And also, what does that take away from me in the night and in the darkness if I were on that walk? It actually drains my ability to be in that space and actually appreciate what's there. And so you start doing this really, well, at least I do internally, the stance of like, well, what do I want actually from other people? How am I expecting to connect? And the tension between, well, I don't want to just connect to them because I can relate to them on every level. I want to be able to connect with them because we are actually quite different. And yet, I also don't want to give up the hope that maybe we can meet in these other ways and become and see it eye to eye. And so it brings up real questions of freedom and compassion. Where do I offer compassion? When am I overstepping someone's freedom, you know, and where am I losing my own?
And also the question, I think, what does politics actually mean in our lives? Because if I, sometimes I can make it sort of play a smaller role, you know, in my life. And I have this hope that this group of people going into the dark, having very different political views, might create something new that is somehow apart from all the politics that divides us. So I don't know if the answer has to be me convincing them politically or the other way around so that we are on the same political sense. But maybe we just have to leave politics behind in a way. But then sometimes I'm afraid that I'm too apolitical or, you know, that. But I know that I do hope that a little bit, because I only feel like creating something new, like in this night walk, might be the only way out for us.
I mean, I couldn't agree more, actually, that the that actually the way that the political field is set up now and its entanglement with the economic sphere mostly has a deadening effect on culture and individuation and experiencing things with our imagination and our full sense of being. And so it's probably, I suppose, in some ways impossible to just completely leave the political realm behind. Only, I don't even mean that in the sense, the cliched sense of everything's political, but I just mean when two or more people start getting together, there become questions of how to mediate that. I mean, there may be, we could almost refer to the gathering and the organizing around the night walks as having some sort of political dimension, not political by I choose this party or this cause, but just in the organizing and everybody feeling like they can participate and come and meet at this specific time and all that sort of stuff. But it is exactly the strengthening of the other sense of being that would allow us to evade that completely collapsed or collapsing political structure that drains so much out of our lives. And so it doesn't surprise me that that ties into things like being in the night, breathing that night air, being in the darkness, looking at the stars, connecting to the size of the cosmos and the size of the planet and our inner space and spirulina, surprising things. But that would be enriching. Like something I tried to say when I did my book tour for my novel, people kept asking me about specific political dimensions or things that might have come up in the novel. And I kept saying, well, I think we also, and maybe you can talk about this as a poet a bit, because poetry is always demanded. There's always this demand that it be political, like to validate itself somehow. But that's what I felt like people were asking constantly. Because it could be seen politically, and I don't want to deny anybody their reading of anything I've written in that way. But I kept saying, you know, we have to strengthen the cultural realm too. We can't just constantly give all our strength to the political sphere and then hope it will sort out culture in some way. Like, we also need to be able to strengthen this part of our lives and enrich it and nourish it. So I guess, yeah, maybe before we move on from there, I would maybe talk about, because also I just want to say one more thing and then I'll let you talk a little bit more, but it's like, there's almost like this idea that like nature, I mean, there is an idea that nature and culture are really opposed, that somehow all the problems of the world are cultural and all the good stuff about the world is like natural, you know? And of course that can be spun in any sort of way, but what you're saying and what I'm, I guess, trying to articulate in my own way is having a culture that is really enriched by touching something that is beyond politics, but is still cultural in a way.
Yeah, it's interesting that these night walks, I try to somehow keep them very far apart. I made a lot of theater the past 10 years. And it was actually a little bit before the pandemic, was good timing for myself. I felt that somehow the theater seemed too closed and I had to get out. I was, for 10 years, I was standing on stage saying the same thing. I was really framed as a very engaged political theater maker. So, and all the press photos, I saw myself with a raised finger on the stage. And I was like, okay, I'm going to quit now. I can't look at myself anymore like that. Or listen to myself, because it was a lot of solo things. And then I started to go into the night and do these night walks. And first, we were part of a theater festival. So it was very much in the context of theater. And then you realize that people were expecting a cultural trip. So they would, you know, buy the ticket and come. And they were a bit offended that we had no flashlights, or that it was actually dark, you know, that they could trip over things. And they did. People would fall all the time because it was just dark. And I thought, yeah, let's make it hard. You know, it's night, so we're going to. And I realized that when it's in the context of sometimes this whole cultural life has become so safe, you know, catered to people just enjoying themselves and being sort of affirming what they already believe, affirming that they're good because art is good and culture is good. And I had this growing feeling that I wanted something else. And then slowly we moved these walks over the past 3 years. We moved them away from cultural festivals, from culture at all. And now it's just, you buy a ticket from our own website, and the only thing you know is no flashlights, and you have to be careful. It's on your own risk. And people come with a completely different attitude. But for me, it's still, actually, these walks for me are poetry. I think it's a poetical way of moving through the world, you know, joining with people you don't know, surrendering to whoever walks in front, which is me, and then just trusting that it will be all right and opening your senses. I think it's the biggest form of poetry. I mean, you don't have to write poetry to engage poetry. And but it's interesting that people see it as less cultural because it's not really based in the context of culture now.
And you've only lost 17 members so far, so it's fine.
Yeah. No, died. No. No, we have a few situations where I thought, okay, this is stretching the boundaries, but
yeah. Well, I mean, I was also just thinking about that's really interesting that, you know, the night it's seen as something sort of primal and old and all that kind of stuff. But now, you know, as you detail the lack of darkness in your book, and as you were just saying, the, you know, overlightedness of where you live, that actually the encounter with it is new again, that there's a completely new experience of this thing that's been with us forever. And I'm thinking about those tensions between the old and the new through time. You know, there's, I wish I knew more Dutch literature, but I don't know that much, but one of the books that I read from there is Gerbrand Bakker, I think it is, The Twin. Yeah, I mean, incredible, incredible book. It's so beautiful and beautifully translated, I presume, because I read in translation. But it, you know, chronicles the someone coming to terms with being on a farm they kind of don't want to be on anymore as this way of farming goes away, and dealing with, you know, an aging member of their family. And the way that those two are pulling apart, I think that, you know, we, in some ways, we tend to view conservatism as, you know, oh, I want to reclaim the past. I want to go back to the past and bring it to the present. But there's also a way of bringing things from the past into the present that allows us to move forward. So, you know, rather than trying to reclaim a nation full of like farms and no immigrants or whatever. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with farms. My father has a farm, but and is an immigrant. but rather, instead of looking to the past, we look at what is in the past and we encounter it with the present and move forward into the future, which is something very different. And it sounds like that's kind of this new experience of the night, which should be as old as can be, but actually is a new experience to us. Yeah.
It's interesting the word conservatism, I think, because in the word is to conserve, right?
Wow. Just yeah.
You hold something which means something to us. And I, in secret, I call myself conservative. Mm. And I have a secret conservative women's club. Men as well. But in which we discuss conservative ideas. Because I'm very attracted to people with conservative ideas. Because I think there is so much truth in, conserving things. And it's so strange, for example, that Green Party somehow are not seen as conservative. Well, what they do is conserve the most precious thing we have, which is the ecology that sustains us and that we are part of. So I think we should really rethink what this word means and who it belongs to and how we use it. And this walking through the night for me definitely feels in a way conservative in the sense that we try to conserve something that has spoken to us for thousands of years and taught us a lot for thousands of years, and now we're losing it, and somehow, you know, that's called progression. Well, actually, there's so much lost when there is no there's no darkness.
Yeah, when I think about that in terms of conservation, you know, I had to actually, she's also has the same publisher as us, Michelle Niehaus. She wrote a book on conservation. Of mostly of animals, and all the work that goes into conservation when it comes to animals, that's really an act of love, and of people coming together and finding new ways in which you can conserve and let something thrive and flourish, which is, you know, the kind of ultra conservatism that we talk about politically is the opposite of that. It's actually just sort of cutting off all the connection and not allowing new connections to come in to conserve through love, which is very different. Actually, conservatism in the way you're talking about it, or the conservative gesture, is in its proper form is a form of coming together to kind of herald and shepherd and offer kind of a safety to thrive without safety, or a safety to thrive wildly, or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it would be interesting if the conservatives gave their term back to the people who actually belongs to, you know, because they profit from that term, because people think, oh, they will keep things the way they are, when actually that's not what's happening. And it's not possible either. But the things that need to be conserved are not conserved at all.
Right, exactly. Well, I wanted to move on to one of the main themes of your book, In Light Years, There's No Hurry, and that is space. And so I'd love for you to read a short passage from it, from the first chapter.
Since the beginning of this heat wave, I have sunk to sleep at night in the bluish light of my screen. I pray for rain, for a puff of wind, for at least a respite from this heat. But the National Weather Service forecasts no change. Drought, drought, drought. Our front yard faces south. All day long, the sun blasts its searing rays onto the plants and the flagstones. The trees on the square are too far away. Their shadows do not reach us. The only thing that shoots up from the sidewalk in front of our house is the street lamp, whose dirty yellow light shines in past the edge of the curtains at night. That light has annoyed me for as long as we've lived here. It's like sleeping in a spotlight. I squeeze my eyes shut, search for something in the darkness, a point of view, no, just a view. That's it. I need a view, a vista. I'm unable to see past this sweltering night, as though the horizon has snuck up on me. has slowly transformed from a faraway pinstripe into a thick, ugly streak that blocks my view. Seems like the fan has gotten louder. Whoosh, whoosh. I've lost my view, lost the future, almost as carelessly as one loses the key to a bike. This can't be. It mustn't be to have children, but no clear prospect. What positive story can I tell them? A decent story needs continuity. And yet it's like everything's gradually become disjointed. Trees without a forest, birds without a flock, fish without a school, humankind boxed in by first impressions, which in my case means white, left wing, female, a cargo bike mom, even without the cargo bike. Where can we go to find something or someone further than ourselves, more than what we seem at first sight? I scroll further, click on a link to an article about ecological grief in Greenland, whose people are confronted with the effects of climate change every day and grieve for their lost world. The Australian environmental philosopher Glenn Albrecht has come up with a name for this emotion, solastalgia, from the Latin solatium, meaning solace, and the Greek word for pain, algia. Where once you found solace in the landscape, now you find pain. Maybe that's what's ailing me. But my sinking feeling is not limited to the landscape. It's the divisiveness in our neighborhood, our city, the country. Things coming undone. It's a daily stream of apocalyptic news. Housing shortage, the burnout epidemic, refugees stuck behind fences, the demise of democracy and of the last northern white rhino. It's my neighbor across the street who calls the climate crisis a left-wing hoax. This year, she's supposed to take her first airplane trip ever, and suddenly she's supposed to be ashamed of it because of the climate cooks like me and our anti-airline industry petitions. Never mind that I used to breeze from continent to continent on vacation in a time when she and her family spent theirs scrunched into a two-room bungalow. I sink, while my children lie in bed a few feet away. And I think of a verse from a poem by Fernando Pessoa that a friend once read to me. Beyond the bend in the road, there may be a well, a castle. There may be simply more road. I neither know nor ask. As long as I'm on the road before the bend, I simply look at the road before the bend, since I can only see the road before the bend. How wonderful and comforting those words once were to me. Whereas now I get short of breath at the thought of that road without sight of the horizon. Solastalgia. I want to climb higher, beyond the bend, look over the valley and the mountains. I am in search of a road that takes me past the doomsday scenarios, past the half solutions and the divisions to a wide and breathtaking vista. An image pops into my mind. The Hubble Ultra Deep Field. A photo taken by the Hubble telescope from some 340 miles above Earth. The most beautiful vista I know. It's a photo of a pitch black background full of illuminated shards. Light that varies from bright white to a kind of soft orange, from fluorescent lamp to light bulb. If you look carefully, the shards all differ in shape. Bizarre spirals, sparkling snail shells, some whose sharp points stick out at all points of the compass, like the Star of Bethlehem. The photo is a composite of a series of observations the telescope made from September 2003 to January 2004. What look like individual shards are in fact 3,000 galaxies, light years from us in the constellation Fornax. We saw to the edge of all there is. Tracy K. Smith wrote in her poem about Hubble's images. So brutal and alive, it seemed to comprehend us back. If you know what you're looking at, the photo is overwhelming. An unassuming bit of darkness above our heads sparkles and shines. Some of the shards of light are the oldest galaxies we know, formed in the first 500 million years after the Big Bang. Galaxies now long extinct because the light we see had been traveling for billions of years before being picked up by the Hubble telescope. Hubble looks not only forward into space, but back in time. The first time I saw the Hubble Ultra Deep Field was in 2006 at the Space Expo, the museum adjoining the European Space Agency Center in Noordwijk. That year, I had undertaken to become the ESA's house poet, a title of my own design. I'd long been fascinated with outer space. For me, the cosmos was the place for not knowing, not being, not seeing. The awareness of it surrounding us had always made me feel liberated. So I emailed the Space Expo asking if I might use the museum as a temporary workplace, adding that I had actually wanted to study astronomy in college, but that it became religious studies instead, specializing in Islamic mysticism, another route to the unknown. The then director sent a friendly email back inviting me to come write in the Space Expo. That photo, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, hung near the entrance to the exhibition space, backlit in an otherwise darkened corridor. I spent entire mornings staring at it, mesmerized. The incomprehensibility of thousands of galaxies, hundreds of billions of stars in all. But no poem came. I got no further than a single stanza. In it, I drew a parallel between the expanse of shards and the Jewish creation myth in which a basin full of light shatters into billions of pieces. According to the myth, all those shards eventually become life. Humans, animals, even words, all of them holy shards of light. And each shard of light, says the myth, is nostalgic for the vat in which everything was once all together. So with every encounter between shards, there is a yearning for yet more light. Whether those shards are people, animals, plants, letters, the broken world is a yearning world.
Thank you. When I then looked up that image, it looks like one of Haeckel's pictures of the sea forms, almost like everything in a row. And that is exactly the perspective I learned almost in a way when I learned science. So I studied with Lynn Margulies, who developed the Gaia theory with James Lovelock, and she worked mostly on symbiosis and symbiogenesis and bacteria. But that was, you know, how I characterized her whole move, was to lean forward and to stand back, to look at the very small and then stand back and look at the very large. She said, I think she said, or maybe Jim said this, but that Gaia, the regulating Earth, is Gaia's symbiosis seen from space. And so when I went and looked at that image, I was really startled by how much it looked like phytoplankton or forams or microscopic organisms as well, just because they're all put in space together. Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's so interesting. Well, you know, the how do you say it in English? As above, so below, or yeah. As below. Yeah, there's so much that seems to mirror the smaller, and I think as I write in my book, for me, the really startling was that I was going on these night walks. It started because I wanted to see more stars in my own hometown. So I do these night walks and I think maybe I can, you know, expand this, make people more conscious of what darkness, that darkness can actually bring more light, because then we can see the stars and everything. And then during my first night walk, I run into the glowworms, which are actually sort of like tiny galaxies in the mud. And that moved me so much. I'm actually still working on glowworms ever since, because they've become like my totem animal. I really felt like they were telling the story that night. Like we're right here. It's right here. And I love it that you don't navigate on glowworms. They just send you straight into the bushes, which is a nice way of living as well. It's very different. I mean, they're the same as the stars, but they're very different in the sense that they don't bring us anywhere.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I don't think we have glowworms here in Ireland. I mean, we might. I don't know. We have fireflies in the US, so that's the thing that I was used to growing up. But those are very common still, I think. I hope.
They are very much, they're very rapidly decreasing.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Also, the glowworms, you actually definitely had glowworms in Ireland.
Oh, we do? Okay. Well,
we've been a whole rewilding program in the UK now for glowworms. back, trying to bring them back.
Well, I was going to say, I did see, you know, in Ireland, there are all these stories about people seeing fairies at night, and often, like you said, it was just reminded of it because they would lead you into a terrible place, actually, if you followed them. But interestingly, when I went out to County Clare with a friend of mine, and it was late at night, and we looked across this field, and across the entire field were these blue lights, and we just kind of looked at each other, and I was like, "Do you see that?" She said, "Yeah." And we kind of covered to make sure it wasn't light refracting from anywhere. It was just covered with blue lights, and we didn't know what it was. But there are lots of surprises in the night, whether it's glowworms or these.
You never found out what it was?
No, I mean, if we would have asked one of the farmers nearby, they would have just told us those were fairies, I'm sure. So I'll take that as what they are, you know. But it was a pretty startling experience. And that, I mean, yeah. Anyway, we won't go down the fairy tunnel right now, but or maybe we can if you want to. But I was thinking also about the, like, on that level of that image, there is at least a comfort that, or comfort might not be the right word, but almost like a, is it a sublime feeling? It's a feeling of, it's a feeling of truth, I suppose, I would say. There's a kind of truth that comes to us in that, in seeing an image like that and connecting with it. And that's something that obviously the whole book expresses, seeking how to actually generate that out of ourselves and our own interactions. So you don't have to go to the moon or space and look down on the planet. And it also comes from looking very deep, you know, towards things that are microscopic or small, looking into the past, looking into the future. So sometimes I wonder, you know, in spite of everything that like Buddhism and mindfulness tells us, that actually the present is the problem. That actually, in some ways, we're, you know, like, it's the connection in this moment that's actually quite difficult. And, you know, I think when we move to these other planes of space or time, we can really be reoriented to, it's not a delusion, that the truth that things are as they should be in their way. So I'm kind of wondering about this trouble of the present scale.
But isn't it, the present is a problem, definitely, but isn't that because we've cut the present off from, you know, from the past and from the future, and from, we've made the present into something completely isolated that only talks to us or has to be sort of filled with our own individual needs, while the present is, this sounds a bit big, but I mean, the present is all compassing. It's that the present is the everything, right? It's a moment that connects future and past. It's the moment that connects you in space. It's a moment that allows you to converse with the world. So there are so many layers to the presence, and I think to the present. And the problem is, of course, that it's not so layered anymore, and that it has become something that you have to use up, you know, like you have to make the most of it, and you have to. Making the most of the present actually just means that you see all the layers of the present. So it means looking back, it means looking forward, it means looking up, looking down, it means seeing all the dimensions of the present.
Yeah, I love that way of looking at it. I think it's like I'm actually undoing the present by seeing as much as I can. Like I was kind of picking on mindfulness there because I have all sorts of problems with mindfulness, to be quite honest, but a lot of the ways it's practiced, it drives us deeper into the present. That's in a way that's really contracted, and that actually as you're saying, if we're attuned to all the levels of existence, it's actually the more we let in can bring in a sort of truth. And that includes not banishing the imagination as something that's merely whimsical and tacked on to reality, but actually the ability to envision and sense the layers of space kind of going up and down, so to speak, and time going out to either side, or however you want to arrange that crucifix. but how much we let in. And I think that that's something that's really powerful about the book, is that it is about more. It's about bringing more in, which is a completely, it really does stand in contrast to a lot of the ways that people would try to deal with their anxiety or frustration or fear of what's going on. But I wonder, then, can we flood ourselves also? Is, you know, the other question, like, sort of blow out our circuitry or something like that, you know?
Yeah, it really depends on how much you can take, right? Of the depth or layers, or and I think my tactic is always when I feel trapped, that I try to make things as large as possible, and see the multi-layeredness and all the interconnectedness, and it can also be very dizzying. And I really understand the urge to make things smaller and to interpret mindfulness as narrowing the present. Although I don't think that is in essence what it should be. I think mindfulness is actually about being so present that you see all those layers. Only it often gets stuck on another level, which is, you know, where are you at the moment and how do you feel, and scan yourself. And I remember, it's a bit off topic, but actually it isn't, but I do a lot of horse riding, and I had a very good time for a few years on this stable. I was horse riding, I was getting better, I was always riding the same horse, I felt I really had a connection with the horse. So, you know, we'll be galloping, and I felt like, wow, I would really like one movement, one organism. And then my trainer, she started to do this coaching traineeship, and she started to make it about me, the horseback riding. So every time something went wrong, she would be like, oh, do you have this? Do you recognize this from your personal life? Do you more often have trouble, getting things to move in your life? If the horse wouldn't walk, or if I would fall off, it would be like, so what's wrong with you today? And it suddenly, it was about the horse having to teach me something. You know what I mean? So it wasn't not about me and the horse, or what was happening between me and the horse, but it was about what the horse taught me about myself. And from that moment, I sucked at horseback riding. So I stopped, because I fell off 3 times, because it was only about me. And I felt so cut off from the whole process of being with this horse, and feeling like we had something going on together. And it really ruined it for me, the whole coaching thing of, you know, me having to listen to the horse to learn about myself, while I actually wanted to learn about the horse, and, you know, what the relation between me and the horse was. And I think that for me, that said a lot about this whole coaching culture, and what you, maybe your trouble with mindfulness, that it makes the experiences so narrow, because it's always about you and about what you have to find out about yourself. And I'm not saying that cannot be interesting. Of course it can, but it can also be very small.
Yeah. Well, I think when it comes to, well, first I would say that when it comes to letting more in, the way that people will often try to do that now is by doing psychedelic or hallucinogenic drugs. And so I want to, let me just shelf that for a second, but maybe circle back to it after I say this about mindfulness. I think the problem that I have with mindfulness does tie into something that you brought up in the book. So it's like, you know, the Marines in the US, they teach mindfulness so you can kill people. And it's like, there was this whole thing of this guy that worked for, you know, the IDF in Israel, that was, he was like a Buddhist monk in Israel that was like trying to give comfort to the soldiers. And it was like, by telling them how to use mindfulness. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, if you shoot someone and you're practicing mindfulness, you know, like all you know is like my finger on the trigger, my pressure here, and now there's an explosion of color over there, that actually there's still a dimension that is not really brought into play through the technique. And you mentioned this in the book, which is, I think, really important, which is, it's not just that people went into space and had this overview effect where they then came back down and wanted to do better. There were some people that were exempt from that effect. And so you say, but you actually have to want that too. And so there's this whole extra dimension of a generative morality that actually puts the lesson into play somehow. And that's this whole extra part that it sounds like when you talk about. So I apply that to mindfulness to say, like, I think the bigger problem is people think it's some sort of it's just inherently good somehow, which is what you see in the portrayal, especially in the US, of Buddhism, is like it's this completely peaceful religion. And, you know, obviously historically that's not true, and mindfulness and Buddhism aren't the same thing anyway, but I think because people can use it in their own lives to calm themselves down, they think, oh, this must be inherently good. But you have to add this extra thing. That it's actually now attuning me to this night walks tension with some of the people that go on the night walks with you. Because actually we're learning by entering into the technique openly, we're actually learning how to generate that sort of moral connection. It's like that's something that's been lost as well. If that makes sense, I think I'm maybe not completely articulating it, but rather than saying like you have to have the moral principle already with you before you practice mindfulness or access the overview effect or whatever, actually these tools can also be, and these experiences can also be ways to learn how to apply the moral principle to the actual tool that you're using in the first place, or the actual effect or perspective you're using in the first place.
Well, how would you practically do that? Because you give people mindfulness and then you give them some sort of, I totally agree with you, but I've always had a bit of a problem with it. I never practiced it also. And I had exactly the same problem with yoga. I have been doing it now because I realize that it gives a lot of space in my body, which I think is very interesting that I suddenly have all this space.
Wow, yeah.
I never thought it was. And so there's space inside of me as well. I find that interesting. But there's a lot of parts of the yoga lesson that still trouble me a bit, because it feels very, how do you say that, self-complimentary, or, you know, or so, I don't know. They are asked to be very, feel so good about themselves. And of course, it's important and we have to be mentally healthy, but sometimes I think that's too much the aim in general. And how can you be mentally healthy on a very unhealthy planet? Or, you know, well, your actions have so many consequences for other people. So, but I don't really know how you would install that in a mindfulness course.
Yeah, or anything. I mean, that's the real trouble. It's something that, like, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we talk, you know, you mentioned awe in the book as well quite a bit, and people also think that that's somehow a default good, but awe can be all, can have all sorts of things. I mean, awe can almost be the fascination of seeing someone, you know, it undergoing great pain as a kind of spectacle when you watch it on your computer screen. Or it can also be, you know, Richard Dawkins and all these people talking about awe, and yet they seem to have these extremely limited, this extremely limited feeling life for other people and the other people's experiences. So I think it's like, it's something more like the fact that you go into the night with the people that you, I don't know. I'm having trouble describing it, but I know you're doing it with that. That's all I know. It's like,
okay, you're
learning and practicing at the same time, you know?
What I think now is that what I try to do is I have exactly the same discomfort with awe But at the same time, it's what I'm searching for, because I do think that this sense of wonder, I like the word wonder. I once spoke to a priest during my studies, and he explained that actually a miracle, this something wondrous that's happening. In Dutch, a miracle is een wonder, so it's a wonder, is something that breaks with time and space as you expect it. So the chronology of time and the three-dimensionality of space. You have these expectations, and you go through life expecting all kinds of things. And because all these expectations often happen, you know, you go out, the sun is shining, or water is wet. So it always plays out according to your expectations. And that's why you lose the sense of wonder, because it becomes expected. And then because you lose the sense of wonder, you cannot imagine something else than the life as it's played out. But to strive for a better world, you need the imagination of a new world. And if everything goes as expected and you expect what happens, nothing will change. So if this wonder comes into your life, this miracle, it breaks with time and space. And it's actually a moment for you to learn that the unexpected is possible. But that is not enough. It's only a possibility to learn something about how to imagine a new world. And well, is it the whole cliche about it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, I think they say. I think in these times, it's so important to have these little miracles or this sense of wonder, of awe, because it can teach you that, yes, something else is possible. Something that breaks with your expectations, something that breaks with the way you think the world works, because it lifts you up from that world. But if you leave it at that, then it doesn't mean anything. Or, well, it means something, but not what I would like it to mean. And I think from there, so you're lifted up, and then the question is, okay, what are you going to do with it? And the reason why I take people into the night walks and then during the night confront them with a story that is often, I don't know, maybe a bit harsh to listen to, you know, this girl, we have one of the night watchers, she was homeless for quite a long time as a young girl, and she talks to people about her experiences in the whole care system where she was completely overlooked and abused. And it's not very soothing to listen to that in a dark forest with people you don't know, but it is part of the, for me, part of the experience. And I think if the sense of awe only gives you a soothing feeling, then you know you miss half of it, because it's all about balance, right? It's all about you go into the night, but also because you need darkness next to the light. And if you have a sense of awe and it only fills you with love and not with fear, or then you miss part of the experience. So I guess it's about always searching the antidote, because things are only true when the opposite is true as well. Who said that? Someone said that. I think that's very true and not true then. yeah, that's it. But yeah, I like that quote that it can never be one thing. If it's only one thing, you know you miss half of it.
Yeah. And just thinking about how to do that dance and navigate all of that, I was thinking when you were talking too about, you know, Maggie Nelson was on the show a while ago, and we were talking about how people really, we're talking about sexual experience and how people very often sort of condemn having this kind of casual hookup culture because, oh, it's like empty or whatever. And Maggie and I were both just saying, but no, like precisely, it's actually the kind of the depth that doing the same kind of we didn't use the word empty, what do we use, familiar or expected thing, just carrying out the same act again and again, even if it's with different people, but with the same act again and again, actually reveals and like opens up all the ability to see all sorts of things. And that sometimes it's not, you know, it's actually the deepening of capacity that comes from repetition over time. You know, it's like the It's sort of related to Félix Guattari, his idea of like a line of flight. Like if you exacerbate something, if you do it so many times, so often, suddenly you achieve this line of flight out of it where you can see, you have an overview effect of actually the orbit, you know, the orbit of your own life or your own behaviors. And that can really be really
profound. For thousands of years.
Say it again. Sorry. What'd you say?
Like with ritual, you know, that you repeat it thousands of years and then you also see. Yeah,
that's right. So I want you to read a poem, but to maybe close things out. But before we read the poem, I do want to ask you about death and afterlife and maybe between lives and all that sort of stuff. Because for me, you know, my understanding of how things go, my experience, I should say, is of reincarnation. Now, people don't have to come along that journey with me, but that is what I experienced to be true. So for me, when we talk about the end of things or the end of human life or the end of the world or whatever, I always just think, okay, yeah, I can handle that. It's actually, that's far too easy for me because we're actually going to have to like keep coming until we get it sorted out, which is actually for me, the greater threat or responsibility. So I'm always like, I better do as much as I can because I'm my own child and I'm going to come back around and, you know, be reborn again into whatever world still exists. And so I guess a lot of the anxiety, of course, is fueled from personal death or some kind of collective death. But I'm wondering how that figures into your overview effect, because in some ways, reincarnation is my overview effect in its own way. It's like, well, I can see the cycles of dying and living the life between this life and the next in the realm of the dead and the coming back. And I can see actually how that might have played out in other lives that I've had and lives of people I've talked with. So that form of time and space offers me something that, you know, that really kind of centers the entire experience of what's happening in the world right now. So I am wondering how death and your understanding of it also figures into the picture that you present here.
Well, I don't know. Do you have children?
No. No, actually, sorry. And before you say that was another thing I was going to bring up, which was just that whole paradox of having kids, you know, I mean, that's its whole own strange thing. But, you know, I'm gay. I'm never going to have kids. And sometimes I feel like just saying, I'm the only environmentalist in the room. I don't want to, like, I could probably throw old shoes in Walden Pond and like not do as much damage as anybody bringing kids, you know, because I know people have tons of kids that are constantly talking about the environment. And on the one hand, I understand why, but on, you know, obviously you want the world to be preserved for your children in a certain way and to allow space to thrive. And on the other hand, I think, but you're, by having the kids, you're creating the exact world in which you hope to prevent. And that does come up in the book a little bit too, but I obviously don't say that because also that gets into, you know, people have strong responses to that as if I sound like I'm want everybody to have their tubes tied or, you know, like snipped or whatever. And I don't mean that. Yeah.
That's why don't we do that? I think about that a lot. Now I also thought about it because, yeah, it's obviously too late for me now. But because you said about reincarnation, that in a way I feel like having children is a way of actually feeling what you feel, like you come back, you know, because you recognize so much of yourself in the children and you see, oh my God, this is gonna go on. And you are your children in a way, you know, you are present in their material. So I feel it that way. Like I'm gonna live as long as that material is in alive in human form. I don't know how long that will be. But there are so many levels to think about this, because if I zoom out very much, then I think, okay, well, humanity might die out. That's not such a problem. You know, the planet will continue. And if not, I don't know. I was a while ago, I was on this huge exoplanetary conference, and that was kind of soothing. I was like, there's so many other planets, you know. Then I felt a bit less worried, maybe. So it really depends on which level you look at it. But yeah, I don't know if this is an answer on death, actually. Maybe for me, doing these night walks is a way of dealing with dying and the feeling of death and the feeling of loss. Walking through it, you know, walking through that darkness and knowing that even in places where you think nothing is happening, there's actually so much happening or unfolding, things that you don't even know. And it's interesting, once you learn to speak sort of the language of the night, you recognize so many sounds and movements and animals that, I mean, there's so many like moths, night butterflies that I've come to recognize now, the glowworms. So then there's suddenly so much movement in what you thought was death or absence. But I don't know. I also feel like I hear a lot from environmentalist people around me that their children are sort of their motor to do something. But I don't really feel that, because I also think that's a bit unfair, because there are so many other children who are already, you know, truly dying. My children are the least, I worry about the least, actually. They're in such a good place. They'll be the last ones to suffer from this.
Yeah. I just want to say, I'm glad you say that, because the way that children are used to justify or dismiss any opinion on anything, it's not that they shouldn't be considered. They should. And in some ways, I'm the least capable of talking about where they should and should not be considered, because I don't have them. But on the other hand, I think, well, maybe some of the distance gives me a little bit of perspective in the ways in which children are utilized to, as you say, be the motor of environmental action, or anything. I mean, it's just it's come up a lot of times on the show, the ways in which people have fantasies about protecting their families as the foundation of their political or cultural views, and it's maybe we can do more than that. I'm not saying don't do that, but let's do more than that, you know, and see what happens.
It always annoys me a little bit when people bring up their children and so like, we do it for them. We do it for them. I'm not sensitive to that argument. No.
Yeah, good. Well, we're not sensitive to it for different reasons, but yeah, good. because, you know, I think a lot of your notoriety comes from being a poet. I didn't want to leave this episode without having you read a poem. And thankfully, some of them are translated into English. And I love the ones that I've read. The one that, for me, strikes me as most interwoven with the things that we've spoken about on this episode is a poem called The Middle. And rather than describe it, I'll just let you read it. So, yeah.
Thanks. The Middle. I know the story from butt to crown, from the first symbiosis to the erect chest, the animals and their echo in us, stored in membranes, pieces of height and heat around the heart. I know the story from ape to man. I know how I stretched into Homo sapiens, restless and perpendicular to the earth. But something in me never stands upright, slides indifferently away from warmth. Despite torches and flints, I smell of damp. In my breast, no urge, but the throb of a sponge. I have become two directions, forwards and backwards, tumbled in time. Inside of me, with prehistoric calm, a snail holds itself back to the beginning, and the human towards the end. Neither is in sight, just this momentary middle.
Thank you for that, Marjolein.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Bye now.